Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. A bill in South Dakota's State House mandates women seeking abortions receive the phone number to fight sex trafficking. A committee of state lawmakers considered Senate Bill 102 this week, and the hearing is a lens into human trafficking in the state. Keely Boltina covers health issues for South Dakota Public Broadcasting, joins us live to talk about the legislation. Keely, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us about the bill.
The bill, Senate Bill 102, says that the Department of Health is going to provide abortion facilities a written note that they're supposed to give women seeking abortions that says, if someone is sexually abusing you or causing you to exchange sex for something of value and you want help, call 911 or the telephone number provided on this notice. And that is an organization that fights sex trafficking. So supporters say that traffickers will force women to have abortions, or that women who are being trafficked will seek abortions because they're terrified of the consequences of a pregnancy. So they think that this is a touch point between a potential survivor and a health professional, and that's why they want to include this in the regulations.
So the health providers are one way to reach those women.
Yes.
What sort of testimony did lawmakers hear?
It was pretty incredible. A woman came to the microphone and introduced herself as Sally Richardson. She says she lives in the Black Hills. She was first from California. She's had six children. She says the person she was dating was a business owner, and she worked with him until in the middle of one night in the winter, he told her to get out of bed, and he took her to a hotel, and he sent her to a hotel room.
And with the slamming of the car door, my boyfriend became my trafficker. I would beg that I didn't want to go. So he started taking me and taking the pictures for the ads. And I would beg. And the more I begged, the more violent the situation became. He took me across the state of South Dakota and all the little cities that we all think are safe. He's there. They're all there because they take pictures of us in hotel rooms, in beds, to sell us.
Keely, would this bill help people like Sally?
The answer, I think, is maybe. I mean, she explains that she took photos of billboards and signs that she saw with numbers for places that she could call and try to seek help and escape. And she, kept those until she felt like there was a time when she could try to call them. She also says that two of her daughters lived with them at the time. And she said that one of them was pregnant and that the trafficker did try to get her daughter to have an abortion. So there's a little bit of anecdotal evidence there that if they had seen a provider who had provided another number, that it would just be one more point of contact with someone who may be being abused.
How did lawmakers respond?
There are seven members on the committee, and they thanked Sally Richardson for her courage, her strength, and said that hearing stories like this is the way that we're going to make changes. And then Chair Senator Deb Soholt, who has a background in nursing and women's health that spans, decades now, she clarifies that the challenges of liberating victims of sex trafficking so that they can become human trafficking survivors. This is what she says about it.
Someone creates power over another person. And the misunderstanding many times in society that power is somehow something you can just shut off. But when somebody comes in and grooms you, mind, body, and spirit, that I own you, and that you are nothing without me, which is consistently the story in violence against women, it takes incredible and extraordinary personhood of strength to start to move in a new direction. And while this bill, in and of itself, doesn't change the landscape of all of that, it just behooves us in South Dakota to create multiple avenues of being able to tell. And that as a society and as a people, we have said enough. And we are providing messages and a hand. So when that opening is right, when finally that person who is in such oppressive relationship has had says, I can't move anymore, for someone to actually ask, and it's going to take people asking, is this happening to you? I mean, I learned a long time ago when a woman was being battered, you don't say, what happened to you? Because they always have a story. I fell, I hit the sink, I did whatever. And the question is, who hit you? And in their eyes, the truth of the matter shows in the flash of a second before the cover story arrives.
Keely, any sense of who's for this bill and who's opposing it at this stage?
Some well-known conservative groups spoke briefly in favor of the measure. No one testified against it. So the legislation to provide sex trafficking help numbers to women seeking abortions now leaves the Health and Human Services Committee with unanimous support.
And from here, Senate Bill 102 goes to the full Senate chamber. SDBB's Keely Baltina, thanks for coming.
You're welcome.
One South Dakota organization working against human trafficking is the New Colossus. Joining me in the studios now at the University of Sioux Falls are founders Polly Dean and Ashley Stadema. Polly, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Ashley, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
Let's start with what the New Colossus is, where you got the name, and sort of what your mission is. Who wants to begin? Polly?
I'll go ahead. Yeah. The New Colossus, we actually got our name. It's the poem that's inscribed on the base of the Statue of Liberty. We started out with a really long, you know, South Dakota Coalition Against Human Trafficking, and we thought that that would work. But we had someone approach us and say, you guys are a little bit more than that. You guys are kind of this beacon of hope, and you're really spreading this message and passing this torch of what we can do to prevent sex trafficking. So that's kind of how we got our name. We've been around as the New Colossus a little over 3 years. But before that, both of us were involved in various organizations, traveling abroad and studying the issue for 8 years or so. I mean, it's the years kind of meshed together after a while. But yeah, it's been quite a while. It's been quite a road.
Foundation of what you do on a weekly basis.
Well, our biggest focus is prevention. And so whatever that entails, we will be a part of. And so like we were talking about this bill that's just been brought to the table, that's imperative for us also to get in front of every single person who may potentially become or come in contact with a victim of human trafficking. So that's clinics, that's medical professionals, that's teachers, that's counselors, that's domestic violence shelters, property managers, you name it. That's kind of our focus on the daily is who can we get in front of, who can we partner with, who can we continue to educate, and who can we learn from so that we can create a safety net for these survivors and victims and hopefully get them identified before it's too late or sooner than has been typically happening.
Let's talk about the phrase, zero is possible. That's something that shows up on your Facebook page.
Yeah.
Is it? Is zero possible?
I sure believe so. It took us, someone just randomly said that to us, and it was actually not pertaining to trafficking at all. But I looked at Ashley, and she looked at me, and we were just like, I think it actually, like, that's perfect. That's kind of our mission. Like, why wouldn't we set a lofty goal like that? The fact that there could be zero victims of human trafficking at some point. And I think with the right tools and the right people getting in front of, like Ashley just said, getting in front of as many people as possible. And just like the testimony just said about flat out asking the question, is this something that's happening to you? And putting it out there, putting it out in the light so that it's not such a dark and scary topic for people to talk about.
Tell me some of those warning signs. What are you looking for?
I mean, there's so many different red flags and vulnerabilities. We talk a lot about that when we talk about vulnerabilities. We talk to students. We talk to parents. What makes someone vulnerable? It could be homelessness. It could be drug or alcohol addiction or abuse. It could just be a relationship that has gone sour and they feel lonely. One of the most targeted populations that we see are single mothers. You would do anything for your child. And an exploiter, a trafficker, knows that. And they use that against you. Whether that be a child you had previously or a child that you are now having with your trafficker, your exploiter.
One of the biggest things I think we talk about is kind of the misidentified and the unidentified. And so what does that mean? And so that's why these domestic violence shelters and law enforcement and all of those things, we love to sit around and talk to them about what each of us, what our roles are in those areas where we come in contact with victims, and how can we better hear them and listen to them and better identify their situation so that, you know, sometimes trafficking cases are masked as domestic violence or rape or those kind of things. And so if we just ask the right questions, sometimes we can get deeper into the story and where those things are happening within a trafficking situation typically. Mm-hmm. There's just other questions you can ask that really get deeper into that story and figure out that because they don't self-identify as a victim of human trafficking, you really have to lay it out there for them. And you can't straight up ask, are you a victim of human trafficking, typically, because a lot of people don't know what even the definition of human trafficking is. But there's ways to get to that point. And I think that the more we talk about it and the more we're aware of those red flags and kind of just even what human trafficking actually is in America, the better identification I think we're going to come across when it comes to victims.
Are there questions to ask? Are there ways to ask the question of somebody that you see and have concerns about?
Mm-hmm. It kind of varies by each person you sit in front of. I used to work at a domestic violence shelter here in town and found that sometimes it is just asking, do you know what human trafficking is? And then if they say no, you explain what human trafficking, the definition of it, sometimes what happens when you're being trafficked or controlled. And sometimes the light bulb goes on and they say, that's exactly what I'm in. It could be questions as far as, are you required to perform specific sex acts for housing, for food, for are you being pressured to do it because of the relationship that you're in? Asking questions like that instead of just the, are you a victim of human trafficking? Are you being trafficked? Are you able to access medical care? Are you able to go to the doctor when you want? Are you fearful of leaving because you owe this person money? Or do you feel like you're in a debt bondage situation? They're not going to understand those words, debt bondage, but that's what law enforcement uses, and that's what we're trying to educate people on, is there's no chains, there's no handcuffs, there's no cages. What we talk about a lot is the chain around the brain. They feel as though there is no option for them. They aren't able to leave. They feel as though they do have to pay this money back, or they do have to perform X number of services to maybe get their documents or get freedom to leave, or these pictures back that are maybe taken of them.
How hard is it to get out of that situation once someone sort of identifies that they're in it?
Yeah, I think it's a massive challenge to get people out of the current situation just because of the fear that's involved. And a lot of times the threat of violence against family members, people that they care about, people they love, sometimes their own children, keeps them in that cycle. We spoke with law enforcement just recently, and they were talking about how this is one of the only crimes that you have to convince somebody that they're a victim. And you get to that point because you sit there and they've had so much of that mental manipulation brought upon them, and that fear based of you've made these choices to get into this position, so good luck asking for help. And so there's a lot of that happens. We hardly have a story where that's not the case. And so getting them to trust you and trust law enforcement and trust the people that can help them is kind of key. And so sometimes that process is pretty long. It can be years, it can be months, we don't know. So we just kind of have to walk alongside every single one of them and provide the needs that they need at that given day by day.
How do you walk alongside somebody and sort of take care of your own souls, if you were, if that's not too much of an overstatement? You've chosen difficult, maybe even grueling work to do in the world. How do you do that with a sense of purpose and a lightness in your step that keeps you going?
I feel like we still don't have a good answer to that question. I mean, being real.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of days we look at each other and we're like, who and why are we, like, who brought us here and why are we here? And we know that there's, you know, we go back, even being here today, repeating these stories and reminding ourselves the challenge that's faced with this, and that we have to stand up and say something, even if it's hard, because we're the ones who are able. And so even though it's difficult and being brave is hard, I feel like our bravery and our challenges are far less than what these victims are enduring. So we do it for them. And we also do it for the kids that we want them to understand and educate, be educated and know like what this actually is so that they don't end up in a situation like this. And so I think that's why we fight. It's not easy. And sometimes we cry. And sometimes we're like, oh my gosh, we just need a little bit of a breather. And I think just remembering too that you have to take time to focus on the good of this world, even though you're kind of walking in this darkness a lot of the time during the day. But there's so much good amongst this. It's just one of those things that if we can all step up to the plate, that's where we believe that zero is possible comes into play, that hopeful piece. That's a tangible piece that anybody can really grasp onto when it comes to human trafficking and fighting that piece. So, yeah, I think it's hard for us most days, and some days we don't know if we can do it the next day, but we always do. So,
and
here
I feel
we are.
Like we've had the conversation of, I mean, it would be easy to quit. It would be a lot easier to quit and act like there isn't a problem in it. But if we're not going to talk about it, who is? If we're not going to go to the kids and go to the middle schools and high schools and tell them what is happening on social media for real, who's going to talk about it then? And so that kind of keeps us going, just knowing that if we don't do it, who's going to? And by us doing it, we're kind of empowering teens and teachers and counselors that you don't have to know every single thing about human trafficking. You don't have to have a degree in human trafficking to talk about it. You just have to start the conversation, and we have to start it now.
How does this intersect with boys? How are boys involved in this?
I mean, there's obviously, we generalize a lot, but there's victims that are boys. The buyers are men and women. One thing that we talk about even at schools when we go educate them on the issue is approximately 52% of traffickers are male. That means close to half are female then. And they're kind of baffled by that because they have this idea of what a pimp looks like, what a trafficker might look like. But sometimes the females, the women, are a bit safer. They're the ones who might get the friend request on Facebook accepted before a male. They're the ones who can seem more friendly and more approachable and maybe an older friend that would be fun to hang out with. So we're finding that a lot of women are involved in that exploitation piece, whether they maybe were exploited at a younger age and have now aged out and are kind of in this life for good because they don't think they have any other options. So they move into a different role in this life.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to boys, our numbers aren't very high for male victims of trafficking. And I don't think that that's because there aren't that many. I think that we have created a society where it's much easier for women to ask for help. There's more resources for women, domestic violence shelters, some of these places where we're identifying victims, you know, the OB clinic, abortion clinics, you know, those kind of things. Women are being identified in these places. And so I think if we had a better understanding, just a general understanding of what human trafficking was, and we talked about it and made it more of a thing that's not taboo, I think that more men will speak up and ask for help.
One more question. I was looking on your Facebook page and I saw a story that you shared about being in a school and a girl coming up, I think it was a girl coming up afterwards saying there's some red flags here, and it was a grooming situation that you were able to talk to her about. Does that happen fairly often for you that someone will sort of respond to you directly after your conversation at a school?
Yeah, and that does happen. And we also, that's why we think it's really important to have teachers and counselors and principals, everyone educated, so that these teens feel comfortable going to staff and asking for help after they've kind of learned and maybe realized that they're in a situation like this. And so that was one of the first schools we'd ever been to. We got a Facebook message, actually, and she sent us the screenshots of this relationship she was having via an app on her phone. And that was kind of a realization for us that we knew what we were saying to be true, but to have real life testimony that, wait a second, I think what you're saying to me is happening to me. And I didn't know that until you put all these pieces together. Help our teens understand what these relationships that they think that they're having might be a boyfriend or someone they love or someone that cares about them is really part of a grooming process. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And that's exactly what was happening in her situation. So we got her the help she needed, set her up with law enforcement. Her teacher knew those kind of things. keep her safe. So, and we did find out a year later that she was graduating high school and she didn't get on the plane that her trafficker was offering to send her. So that was a turning point for us to just really dig into these schools and invest in our kids. Because they matter and they're our future generation. And so if we are going to make zero as possible, we have to stop it before it starts.
Ashley Stadema is the CEO and co-founder of the New Colossus. Thanks for being here, Ashley.
Thank you.
And Polly Dean, also with us. She's the COO and co-founder of the New Colossus. Polly, thanks as well.
Thank you.
You can follow them on Facebook or find them online at thenewcolossus.org. I'll spell Colossus, C-O-L-O-S-S-U-S. Welcome back to In the Moment. We're talking this hour about human trafficking, and one of the challenges in reaching out to victims of sex trafficking is a fear of law enforcement. SDPB's Keely Bultina caught up with Attorney General from South Dakota, Marty Jackley, to talk about it.
South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley, thanks for talking with me today.
Sure.
I want to talk about the law enforcement aspect of sex trafficking and human trafficking, because we've kind of shifted in different law enforcement communities how you try to find people who are engaging in these crimes and how to deal with the different facets of it.
We have. I mean, obviously, we see in law enforcement situations where sometimes a sexual predator will prey upon young children using technology, sometimes using different ways to communicate. And so we've really focused on both real victims, which we unfortunately have seen here in South Dakota, and how to help them, and also with, I call it our catch a predator operations that we run with local, state, and federal law enforcement, that we basically, you know, work to go find the sexual predators before they harm one of our victims. And so it's really a twofold approach, both dealing with real victims and finding them and reaching out to them, but also, you know, putting in play operations that catch the bad guys before they harm a real child.
And tell me about that difference where you're looking at catching the bad guys versus simply handing out punishments for prostitution, because there's been a shift there too.
There has been, and we have to be very careful, because oftentimes when we come across these cases, there are different degrees of involvement. And so what we look at are basically whether or not there was coercion. We look at all of the facts surrounding how this happened, and we're very careful to make sure that we don't re-victimize a victim. And we've been very fortunate in South Dakota. We've had strong cooperation from victims groups, from the faith-based community, to help us identify the victims and make sure that we're treating those individuals like victims.
I know you work to dispel this notion, and you have for years, but sex trafficking, human trafficking, still feels like something that happens in the dark, in an alley, in a big city, not in a quaint South Dakota town that's surrounded by farmland. That's not really accurate, though.
That's correct. I mean, when you look across the nation, we've had an increase in sex trafficking, and that's why I'm joining up with the Attorney General Mark Herring from Virginia, and we're putting forth at the end of February with the nation's attorney generals a project, Project Vic, to basically help increase the operations and the activities that the law enforcement community puts in place. And so we're seeing that across the nation. When you look at South Dakota, we've had those instances with real victims, but we've run certain operations where we've been able to make, as of right now, 47 different arrests. And so based upon those numbers alone over the last several years, it exists here in small town South Dakota. Oftentimes, and it's concerning, you will have sexual predators come from out of state or perhaps even out of country looking to prey upon children here in South Dakota. And that's why these operations are so important when local, federal, and state authorities join together to put the resources together to make sure we remove these predators from our streets before they harm an actual child.
So is it fair to say then that law enforcement has more of an awareness that this is happening as opposed to what they thought it used to look like, or before the internet even, maybe?
That's extremely fair. I mean, if you look at the law enforcement operations, the very first operation we ran in February of 2013 was in Watertown, South Dakota. We ran it for 2 days, and we made no arrests. Since then, we've ran several different operations, and we've made 47 arrests. And I think this has opened everybody's eyes that what we were hearing from other parts of the country, we're not immune from here in South Dakota. It doesn't happen as prevalent, but it happens too often. And so we need to continue to focus on real victims and reach out to the faith-based groups and to other groups that help victims to have them help us identify sexual predators. And in like token, we also need to focus continuously on our law enforcement operations where we catch those predators before they harm a child.
Outside of the work that you're doing with law enforcement at different levels across different states, what can just everyday people do? What are we supposed to look for? Or how are we supposed to move this issue forward?
You know, oftentimes it's just to identify a circumstance where perhaps a child is acting differently. Perhaps it's a straight-A student that all of a sudden, you know, has failing grades. Perhaps it's somebody that was very social that all of a sudden, you know, became isolated. To look for major changes in somebody's lifestyle and then ask the question, you know, why is this happening? And sometimes ask the child and listen. And the hope is that if we ask more questions, if we pay more attention, there are those instances where a child, and whether it be sex trafficking, whether it be some type of a, you know, child violence situation, there are things that we can do as a society to help identify this and then turn to either law enforcement or some of the victim groups for help.
We know that human trafficking involves immense abuse and manipulation. So how do you combat that as law enforcement when people are abused to the extent that they fear their captors, but they also fear law enforcement and what might be done to them if they do seek help?
You know, oftentimes the best thing that we can do are run the proactive operations, to continue to run these operations where we know we are identifying those individuals that pose a serious risk of doing harm to children, that we take action to make sure that we arrest them before they harm a child. You know, the other aspect is to continually to gain the public's trust, to see that law enforcement isn't arresting victims, that we can't point to any cases in South Dakota where a state's attorney, an attorney general, or a sheriff or a chief has acted inappropriately towards a victim, that to make sure that we're continually reaching out to those faith-based organizations and other victims groups to make sure there's a level of trust that we're also here to be part of the solution and to help those individuals that have been coerced into doing something that they didn't want to do or being forced into things that are simply inappropriate.
South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley, thank you for your time.
Sure, Keely.
And I'm Keely Boltina with South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
You're listening to In the Moment, South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're broadcasting today live from the studios at the University of Sioux Falls. With me in the studio now is Pat Hammond. We're going to continue our conversation about human trafficking by widening the lens a bit and bringing in some global questions and conversations. Pat, welcome to In the Moment.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
And my moment of full disclosure is that you and I are dear friends. You've been my friend for years, and one of my first memories of knowing you is the work that you have done in human trafficking in India. And so every once in a while when a conversation comes up, it's okay to call in your friends.
And yes,
they
it
show
is.
And they show up for you. Mm-hmm. And so tell us a little bit about Rahab's Rope.
Rahab's Rope is an organization that was founded in 2004 by a woman by the name of Vicki Moore, and they are headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia. Vicki Moore was listening to the radio, and she heard about just the atrocities of human trafficking that were going on, and she said, why isn't somebody doing something about this? Mm-hmm. And then she thought about it, and she heard of something leading her that said, you know, why don't you do something about it? Mm-hmm. And so that drove her to India, and then I actually went to India with some friends of mine, and we actually just followed her. So we were there just after her. And so with her paving the way, we were able to step into something that I really had no idea what I was doing.
Tell me about the first time you were in India and some of those conversations you had, some of the things that you saw.
You know, India is an entirely different place than anything that I'm ever used to seeing. So when I went, I really had no idea what we were getting into. But what we found is women are women wherever you go. The women in India that were in prostitution were the ones that we were trying to reach. We were trying to work with the India Gospel League, actually. We gave some life skills classes. We just spent time with them. We visited with them. We saw them. We actually could relate to them. And, you know, at first, the women wouldn't even look at us. They wouldn't look at us in the eye. And we just kept talking to them and just trying to share the idea that they do have worth. And the next day that we visited with them, they would look us in the eye. And then the day after that, they would accept a hug. The day after that, they would take a hug. So it was just such a joy and a marvel to see women kind of just open up with just a little bit of affirmation, a little bit of human touch, just a little bit of somebody saying, you know, I see you and I care about you.
How do they live? What are their living conditions like?
I was back in India just, a year ago. It varies. We spent a lot of time on this past trip in two of the largest slums in Goa. That's a housing area where we were actually in one of the smaller slums. 100,000 people live in one room, kind of stucco-type buildings. One room, you can have as much as, you know, 8 people living in there. They cook in there. You know, there's no sanitary system. There's no running water except a well that they might have in the area. Maybe a communal shower for 80 or so people as part of the slum. No doors, no windows. There might be a piece of material for a door. So, you know, no privacy, lights, electricity comes and goes.
What were they telling you, these women who are in prostitution, about, you know, what do they want to talk about with you? What stories do they have to tell?
Yeah, you know, they really wanted to, you know, first of all, know about us. You know, why were we there? Why would we leave our families and travel halfway around the world just to see them and just to meet them? They could not understand that at all. And so we just started talking about families and kids, and that just opened up everything, because women are women wherever you go. And, you know, you talk about your kids, and then, you know, you talk about, we would ask them, well, what do they do, and what do they want? And then, you know, that was another interesting thing when you start talking to these women about, you know, what do you want to do? And for a lot of the women we talked to, especially the older women, and we talked to women who were in prostitution, and they were 60, 70 years old. They had done this their whole life, and it never crossed their mind to think that they could do anything else. And so what's kind of interesting is when you talk to older women and you say, well, what would you like to do if you could do anything? And then to help them think about it, and one would say, well, you know, I kind of like sewing. And one would say, well, I kind of like baking. And then you just pursue that. And then what's really interesting, too, is when you're working with elementary age kids. That's one thing Rahab's Rope does a lot. They work in prevention. Mm-hmm. They really try to get prevention. So you work with these kids that are, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, and you say, what do you want to do? And some of these are at risk for human trafficking because they live in very, very poor socioeconomic situations. They're not allowed to go to school. You just can't. One reason is the school's far away. You have to take the public transportation to get there. If you're 8 years old, that is not safe. And so they don't go to school. So, you know, getting them to think about what can they do, what do they want to do, get them to just think beyond and then give them some tools to help them achieve that.
Do you think some of those means of prevention also apply to young kids in South Dakota? Or is it such a different world that it doesn't match up?
It was so much fun listening to Polly and Ashley talk, because I was going, yes, 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 yes. Because everything that they were saying is so applicable, because kids are kids wherever you go.
Yeah.
When it comes to prevention, there are a lot of things that we can do with law enforcement and schools. The hospitality industry is getting great at noticing things. Truckers have a coalition. They are getting great at. But, you know, I think it starts at even a neighborhood level. It starts with actually seeing these kids, talking to these kids, mentoring them, just getting to know, letting them know that they have worth. If you can build up self-esteem, a sense of worth, if you can help somehow nurture a child that way to give them confidence, they're given some tools that might help them say, no, this isn't right. You can't have me. And I think that's something that we as adults really need to work on. We need to say, you know, you can't have our children. You can't have anybody's children, not just the ones in our town, not just the ones right here. You can't have any of them. And that starts with getting to know these kids.
Yeah. When we talked to Polly and Ashley, I asked them sort of how are they coming to do their work on an ongoing basis and not sort of sacrificing their own sense of joy or not being damaged by it themselves, because it's challenging, difficult work. You've been to India more than once. You've been other places in the world doing mission work. And then you come home and you get to take a nice hot shower and be back in South Dakota. How have you sort of found those ways over a lifetime of service to others?
It really is hard. Anyone who is in a service profession, it's so easy to become engulfed in that world if you let it. The key is to enter that world but not become a part of it. And that's really hard. But when you enter the chaos, you have to be able to say, okay, I see it. I'm going to do what I can, but I'm going to be able to also step away from it and find something then that nourishes my soul, so I don't bring that with me. I mean, I carry that in my heart because I have such a love for women who are trafficked. And this isn't just women. These are little kids, actually, too. What I do for myself is I go to Patland. La La Land, you know, I immerse myself in my family.
Yeah.
And I try to surround myself with the love that I have with my family and our daughter. And I try to do what I can in my own little corner of the world.
Let it be good for a while, too.
Yes. Yeah.
Pat Hammond is with us today. The organization we've been talking about is called Rahab's Rope, R-A-H-A-B is how you spell Rahab. You can look that up online, too. And earlier we had the new Colossus. If you're doing some work in the world that you'd like us to hear about, I'd like to hear about it, too. Give me a text, 956-SDPB, or send me an email inthemoment@sdpb.org. Pat Hammond, thank you for being here today.
Oh, it's always my pleasure, my friend.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. SDPB contributor Kevin Wooster joins us on Thursdays. You can follow Kevin on his blog. It's called On the Other Hand, and find it online, sdpb.org/Wooster. Kevin, welcome back to In the Moment.
Hey, Lori. Good to be back.
This week's blog post, let's start here because it's a very... I said, I think in the introduction, it's a very human reaction to a sort of an inhuman crime, if I can call it that. Tell me what happened in Rapid City recently.
Well, I think that it's one of those horrible tragedies that localize violence and localize crime in ways that just really unsettle people. And we all operate on the assumption that we're in this little cocoon or this little globe of safety, and especially if you're living in what you call nice neighborhoods and a lot of people around, kids around. And so when I saw it on TV in the early morning, because we had pictures live and the police chief was down at the little convenience store that's just a few blocks away from where we live in the West Boulevard area, and it's right next to the Wilson Elementary School, that where our grandkids go to school, and was a beautiful little park there, and that there was a stabbing, and a Cassie Lord, a clerk, was killed, stabbed multiple times, and apparently when trying to stop the theft of some beer by a 19-year-old and a 17-year-old. And it was, I think a couple things happened. One, that we've had a lot of casino robberies and things like that where people come in and take things, and maybe somebody gets pushed around a little bit or something, but usually not much happens. And the idea that a clerk, somebody completely apart from all this, just happened to be there doing her job at 4:45 or 4:30 in the morning, would end up stabbed more than 30 times and dead, is just, of course, shocked the whole area. And that's what I wrote about, how this sudden, tragedy in a neighborhood shakes people up.
Hmm. And Rapid City Police Chief Carl Jagras was even said it, he'd never seen anything like that before, and he's seen a lot. And he lives that life every day, and this one was something that he even said, was a vile and savage act he had not ever seen before. And all this ties back to this larger conversation then about meth in South Dakota and about criminal justice reform. Tell me about that connection.
Well, it does. And Carl Jagger's been in the law enforcement 22 years, police chief, and has seen a lot of bad things. But this, he was stunned by this as well. And he also has a connection to the school, as a son that goes there. And, he's from this part of town and does junior achievement classes there. And I think did one there maybe the day of or the day after this happened. So he's got a personal investment there as well as a professional one. But he ties some of this to the breakdown in family, the breakdown in some community segments because of methamphetamine. And that, he alleges, and I think has the criminal records to show that the 17-year-old, who's considered to be the stabber in this, grew up in a home where meth was used. It's unclear if he used meth or if there was any direct implications here, but Jagras argues that there is a destructive effect that dehumanizes people and can dehumanize children and make them behave ways that they wouldn't act. I know former chief and current mayor Steve Allender sent out a tweet, I think, that morning and said something like, love your kids and teach them to be human. And I think that's kind of the message Jagras is saying, that meth is dehumanizing people in ways that make them behave in horribly violent ways. And Pennington County State's Attorney Mark Barkle kind of affirms that, while not talking about this specifically, that here and in Miami, where he also worked as a prosecutor, he said every time meth shows up in a community, violence ticks up, it goes up. And it's hard to define exactly the direct effects versus the indirect effects, but they are pervasive.
And looking at Senate Bill 70 from a few years ago and saying there's some good things that came out of that, and then possibly there's some gaps that maybe need to be readjusted. Explain that to me and tell me if that's a direct connection to a case like this or not.
Well, Carl Jagras believes there's a connection there. He, like most of us, I think we all celebrated SB 70 and the whole notion of alternate sentencing that don't put so many people in prison if they don't really need to be there, provide some treatment options, provide some other options for people that are considered nonviolent. And I think he supports the intent of that and that it's a great idea. But I think his argument is that it may be, in his words, went a little, there was kind of the whole meth thing got dropped a little bit, and that maybe some of the people that are turned back out on the street needed to be not out on the street. And there needs to be more direct treatment options, supervision, things like that. And that his contention is that meth kind of got lost. And he considers that, and a lot of law enforcement and prosecutors consider meth to be kind of a creature on its own in the way that it affects people, the way that it affects communities, and the way that it has to be addressed by law enforcement. So they've worked, met with the governor. The governor, I think, whose actions were well-intended on SB 70 and mostly effective, most people, I think, would argue. And he's beginning a kind of a revised or reaffirmed anti-meth initiative that with some more people involved, some more officers involved, and yet with some continuing options that if people on meth or other drugs are willing to do a treatment option, are willing to take responsibility and go through a process, they could get a felony moved down to a misdemeanor once. One time they'd be given that option. So they're still trying to provide alternatives, but with a little bit more harder edge on the law enforcement side.
Hmm. And you can see that blog online, sdpb.org/Wooster. Wooster has one O in it, W-O-S-T-E-R. Kevin, it's a really compelling work and sort of a beginning of a tribute to Cassie Lord, too, as well, yeah. and who she is and yeah. who she remains to be in the lives of her family. And before I let you go, I want to segue a little bit and touch on this issue of hunting and licenses. And I haven't had a chance to look into it, but it's kind of catching fire on the SDPB Facebook page. And you are a longtime hunter. And so maybe as you look at it, you can understand it more quickly than I can. What have you been able to sort of find out about what's going on regarding hunting licenses?
Well, House Bill 1094 is essentially a landowner-driven bill that would provide options for landowners who have deer on their property, often big bucks. They'd like to bring hunters in, willing to pay quite a bit of money to hunt those bucks. But unlike pheasants, where anybody can buy a pheasant license, you know, they're unlimited sales. You just buy them. So if a guy's got a commercial operation, the guy's from Toledo or Minneapolis or Sioux Falls, buy their license and hunt, pay for it. It's a drawing process with limited licenses available in each management unit, and sometimes the people that want to pay the big money don't draw a license. So the landowners in certain areas have been trying for years to get the ability to receive licenses and then transfer, most cases sell those licenses to somebody that wants it. So that's the issue here. It always brings a lot of emotional verbal gunfire when it comes into the legislature. The South Dakota Wildlife Federation, other resident sportsmen's groups, and folks will argue that it disadvantages the rich people, and we should not be doing that. So it'll be a fight. Game Fish and Parks will oppose it because their argument is it strains the system and could put an advantage on wealthy people over the regular hunter. So,
well, it's something that we're going to follow up on, and Kevin Wooster's heading to Pierre, so we'll look forward to hearing what that experience is like for you. How long has it been since you've been to the State House during session?
I think it's been 10 years since I've covered a whole session, probably 5 since I've gone out and actually written some stories, so I may not recognize anybody.
I think that's unlikely, but they'll all recognize you, and we look forward to hearing from you next week. Thanks, Kevin.
Okay, thanks.